Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In the second half of today's show, we'll dive into last night's Republican gubernatorial debate between Lieutenant Governor Tammy Miller and Representative Kelly Armstrong. We'll analyze the event with our news director, Dave Thompson. And we'll also explore the concept of book showers in a Plainsfolk essay by Tom Ezern. And now joining me in our Fargo studio is my co-host, Ashley Thornburg.
Hello.
Ashley, how are you today?
I'm well. And in the second half of today's show, I'll be talking with Rick Guion about chicken wings for Prairie Plates. But we're going to start today's show with a far more serious topic, and that is Matthew Shepard. 25 years ago, last October, Shepard was beaten and left for dead in Laramie, Wyoming. His death sparked legislation about hate crimes and protections for LGBTQ plus people. Concordia College is hosting a series of events and art projects about the legacy of his life and death. There's a play, a choral performance, a sculpture, installation, and more. We visit with Dr. Michael Culleton, one of the main organizers of the campus-wide conversation. Dr. Culleton, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be back with you. Thank you.
What do you remember about learning about Matthew Shepard's tragic death?
October of 1998, I had moved to Tucson, Arizona for graduate school. And it's kind of like one of those moments in American history, like I remember the Columbine shooting, for example, where I just have visions of the Today Show running stories and introducing us to the situation and to Matthew and his family and the community of Laramie. And yeah, ingrained in my head is just, it is the Today Show and waking up in Tucson. And I felt closer maybe to Wyoming than I had when I was in Minnesota and felt like, gosh, that's somewhere down here is southwest-ish and all. And so, yes, I remember that. I was old enough to have a concern for the news and concern for the human element. And I just remember the news stories.
Yeah.
And they're just tragic.
It's a multifaceted art installation. There will be music, there will be theater, there will be sculpture. I was really intrigued to read that this idea to do this project kind of came to you. You were inspired having seen some of the elements that you are now in charge of presenting here at Concordia, but inspired by his youthful optimism. And yeah, it's so easy when somebody dies tragically for them to become a symbol of only pain.
Yes, yes.
What is it about the optimism that stands out so much to you?
Well, one of the things that strikes me in this case, particularly about Matthew, is that we sing the lyrics in this piece that come right out of his journal. Hmm. And he spent time in his journal writing about all the things that he loves. And it is such a long list. And the things that he loved were so wide-ranging. And we kind of see it in the pictures of Matthew with this beaming smile, this grin. The piece even uses lyrics about braces. And his frame was very slight. And we just kind of see this optimism through what was left behind from Matthew in his own journal. And I think that's one of the things that people have caught on to with Matthew. And I think that's why his story has resonated for all of these years. There was a positive spirit. His parents speak of that, write about it. But the fact that we have it in Matthew's own words, and we'll be singing those words, makes it a very endearing persona. There are movies about the Matthew Shepard story. You mentioned plays and artwork and music. And I just felt like as we recognized the 25th anniversary of Matthew's murder this past October, we are recognizing it throughout the academic year in the work that we do. And this has been a real capstone project for several different corners of our campus. You nailed it when you mention that we think of pain, but there's also hope, and we try to find the joy in that which is left behind. And this piece presents a lot of difficult moments. We recognize the circumstances of Matthew's murder. We recognize his murder as a young gay college student. What moved me as I started dreaming about this back in January of 2023, as I start to think about what does the next year look like, I knew that we were coming up on this 25th anniversary. And I just had this idea that if I did Considering Matthew Shepard, I wonder if my colleagues in theater would do the Laramie Project, which is a stage play that explores the tragic events surrounding Matthew's death. And I wonder if there's art elements. As a college, we have an art department and students, and sure enough, we will have an art exhibit. And we'll have a moment on Saturday for the community to join together and to sing together. We think about singing in funerals and Amazing Graces and When the Saints Go Marching In, and music brings us together. And that's always been one of the great powers about it. So we felt that one of the things we wanted to do was invite the community into our singing. So we'll do a community sing event at 2 o'clock in the Centrum, in which—
And that's on Saturday.
On Saturday, yep, at 2 o'clock. And we will invite anybody in the community who would like to come and sing with us. We're going to use a resource called the Justice Choir Songbook. And we'll be singing for other humans. We'll fight other fights that day, so to say, and sing and explore how we can be the best humans that we can be and show love to each other and go ahead and disagree, but show the love that we are capable of giving to other people. And that's what I'm excited to do this coming weekend through the stage play that opens on Thursday night, all the way through this capstone on Sunday at 2 o'clock in Memorial Auditorium, when all 200 singers and a band, pit orchestra kind of thing, if you will, an ensemble of faculty and staff join together to present Considering Matthew Shepard, a work that is painful and a work that is optimistic and tells us a little bit about what we need to do to treat each other well.
Let's visit a little bit of the optimistic end of things. This is Considering Matthew Shepard, Ordinary Boy, and this is, like you mentioned, inspired by words from his own journal.
I love theater, I love good friends, I love succeeding, I love pasta, I love jogging, I love walking and feeling good.
I love yoga and driving and music and helping and smiling and Charlie and Jeopardy. I love movies and eating and positive people and pasta and driving and walking and jogging and racing and learning and metaphors and music and smiling and running and being myself. I love theater. I love theater.
And I love to be
on stage.
So that was a piece from Ordinary Boy from Considering Matthew Shepard. This is one of several pieces of art being performed throughout the week at Concordia College. You can find the whole list at concordiacollege.edu/Matthew Shepard. We're visiting today with Dr. Michael Culleton, who, among your many titles in this specific case, was got the ball rolling on this project here. And before we introduced this piece, when you were talking about it, you said, "We'll be singing his words," and I can't help but notice that your voice changed dramatically when you said that. It was almost like you were fighting back something that was coming up. What does it mean to you as a performer to be responsible for somebody's words?
Well, that's a great responsibility. And it's a great enough responsibility to be in charge of trying to interpret a composer's music.
Mm.
And when you throw on into the musical mix that you're also responsible for representing somebody's own words, it becomes this great, great honor. This is a super honor. And I should say, Matthew's words aren't the only words that we sing throughout this piece. We're going to sing words of a lot of different people who were involved in this tragic event. His mother's represented in the piece. Aaron and Russell are represented in this piece. And Matthew, of course.
And even the protesters.
There were protesters at Matthew's funeral. And they were one of the worst parts of the story. When you think about the pain that a family is going through on the day that they have to bury their child, and there's the Westboro Baptist Church protesters. And Craig Halla Johnson is the composer of this piece, and he himself identifies as a gay man, and he made a tough decision. He represented the protesters in the piece, and there's a movement called Protester. And it's really one of the tougher moments in the piece of music because the choir is asked to take on the character of the protesters. And so some of the language that they sing comes right off of the signs that were being held. And the signs that were being held did not hold upon them many of the words that our students want to say out loud. Mm. And we practiced that movement for a long time, just doing do, 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 you know, just syllables, not even using the words. And I remember we were in recital hall, and I'm glad to say it's only about 80 seconds of a 90-minute work that we're encountering this.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember standing in the middle of recital hall and saying, okay, it's time to put the text with this. And we had talked about it. We had given ample time for students to study the text. And I remember just saying, let's take 15 seconds to just breathe and prepare how you want to prepare or need to prepare to dive into this, to sing words that we hope to never sing ever again in any other context. It's a hard moment, that movement about the protester. But we had the pleasure of having Craig Halla Johnson, the composer, with us via Zoom on the big screens in the recital hall last week. And our students are curious about his decision to include this in the oratorio. Craig had been asked that probably hundreds of times since he's written the work. And what he explained to us was that if we're going to sing a final chorus about how we need to be the ones, all of us, to help heal the world, no matter what the prejudice is that we're trying to heal or to bring understanding to, then we need to contextualize the need for that.
Mm.
And, you know, I can think of it in another scenario, too, because one of my other hats that I wear, I'm a church choir conductor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Moorhead, and we just celebrated the season of Easter. Well, Easter Sunday means a lot more because 2 days before that, you go through Good Friday. And sometimes we need that pain to contextualize the joy or the hope that is felt. And so really, that's why Craig included and made the tough decision to include that moment in the piece, in the movement called Protester.
Yeah.
Powerful choice.
You are working at Concordia, which is a Christian college.
Yeah.
It's a Lutheran college specifically. Yeah. And for many Christians, homosexuality is a grave sin. Mm-hmm. Did you get any pushback from the higher ups?
No pushback whatsoever, only great support. I'm not inviting our listeners. They're welcome to send me emails. Since we've announced this and even performed some of the piece, I've received exactly one email asking us not to do it. You know, one is, it's about right. And 'cause we're going to do this.
Why was it important to your faith to explore this?
I do surround myself with college-aged people on a daily basis. And some of those students identify in the same LGBTQ plus community that Matthew identified in. And I think that it is important that all of my students know that I love them and that we love them as a college and that we welcome them as they are into our time together. And that's what I wanted them to know. And that's why I wanted to pay tribute to this anniversary. These students that I work with, and I love it. It is an absolute dream situation that I find myself in, getting to work with creative young people at this point in their life. But none of them were alive when Matthew Shepard
right.
was murdered. And I think he's an important person to know about, and we have this opportunity to sing of him and to take the stage on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday with the Laramie Project, and we'll sing of Matthew on Sunday. But all of these plays, moments on the stage and moments in the concert hall, they're about Matthew, but they're also about us being filled with hope, love, joy, optimism, acceptance. And I want that to be part of the lesson, too.
Yeah. Yeah, how do you kind of balance that? I'm sure there's no easy answer for that. But when you are teaching kids to how to explore the full range of human emotion, which, you know, we're fairly complicated creatures.
Yeah. When you're teaching young adults about considering Matthew Shepard, the truth is my colleague Joseph Kemper and I, we don't have to say much. they will, and they have spoken.
Mm.
And they have said some of the most meaningful things that I've ever heard said out loud by students in a room, in a classroom, or in a rehearsal room. And I will say this, too, that at the beginning of the process, I was pretty clear to the students that I refuse to impose upon them emotions that they have to feel to do this work. That if some students hold views different than others in the room, that they too are loved and welcomed into the discomfort of this piece of music, and that they can accept this work on whatever level they want to accept the work. And but there's been no student. The only real pushback from students was just simply, do we have to sing those words in that one movement?
Mm. Anti-gay slurs, I'm assuming
you're
saying? Okay.
Yep, right off of the posters that were being chanted and held up at the funeral of Matthew. And that was a hard bridge to cross, but we asked Craig about that too. And again, it's okay to provide a painful context for the rest of the work. This work is brimming with optimism and the recognition that good people exist and that good people make bad choices and that we all have the ability to make somebody's life better or worse with our words or actions. And the way that we explore those ideas throughout the piece is inspiring, and it's inspired hundreds of performances all around the United States and all around the world. One of my favorite videos on YouTube of it is a German choir singing the piece.
Hmm.
So, I mean, it's really resonating, but I think the reason I really wanted to do this weekend was so that we can show love to all of our students, so that our students can be seen and heard, and we have seen them and we have heard them through the process of learning this piece. And I think that the majority of people in our world would be inspired by what our students have said and what they'll accomplish this weekend.
We're visiting today with Dr. Michael Culleton, one of the driving forces behind the Considering Matthew Shepard 25 Years Later project, with events that have been happening throughout the academic year and culminating in a number of art performances and installations at Concordia Thursday through Sunday. You can find out more at concordiacollege.edu/Matthew Shepherd. Why did you want to make this multi-art faceted?
Versus just choir music,
yeah.
You mean?
Yeah, that's your specialty.
It is.
You know, not that you can't know about sculpture, but...
What's a play? The liberal arts environment that I get to work in every day is about celebrating all sorts of different ways to look at things. And the Laramie Project is a really meaningful stage work. It was built around hundreds of interviews with residents of Laramie in the days and years that followed Matthew's murder. And it's an important stage piece. And so I floated it to David Winterstein more than a year ago, and he was a very quick yes. Mm. Very quick yes on we could make this work out. And that there's just a synergy that can be created when we look at things from different angles. And that's what I was excited about doing, and I was really, really pleased when we got backing from, or I should say a partnership with a theater, and Roxanne Case in our cultural events said yes to this right away. Like, not only, oh, yeah, I support this, but let's put this on the cultural events series. Let us promote this all year long, and let's be part of sharing this with the community at large. So, but I was excited about it just basically because we're in a situation where we can do that, and sometimes, you know, even if I was doing this with my community choir, the Fargo Moorhead Choral Artists, it would be harder to do anything except for the choral work. But in the environment of a college situation where you've got willing partners, use them and make it really meaningful.
It's always really intriguing when somebody's death becomes their legacy.
Yes. Yep.
How do you describe Matthew's legacy?
Both Judy and Dennis, his parents, have spoken and written about they have no interest in celebrating Matthew as a martyr of any kind. Matthew was a young man who was murdered. But his legacy can be celebrated in that laws have been enacted. The country has made changes using Matthew's name to better the lives of especially members of the LGBTQ plus community. And so the legacy of Matthew is that he is one of those names and humans that has led to change, sadly not able to see it. And hopefully members of the LGBTQ plus community would say that in numerous ways their lives are better because of the awareness that came through the awful events and the tragic events of Matthew's murder. The legacy, I'm with Matthew's parents on that. We're not holding up Matthew to be any martyr or saint. We're recognizing that through Matthew's death, a large segment of our population has seen changes and awareness that I think they would say has made their lives better.
Dr. Michael Culleton, Concordia College's Director of Choral Activities, a number of events happening Thursday through Sunday on the campus of Concordia College for the Considering Matthew Shepherd 25 Years Later project. This includes a choral performance, a theater performance, and artwork. You can find out more at concordiacollege.edu/Matthew Shepherd. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure to always come talk to you, and thank you, listeners. And I hope that you'll find your way to campus over the next several days and celebrate really what is our year-end culminating efforts for many, many of our students.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at starianbank.com.
Still to come on Main Street, a review of last night's gubernatorial debate with our news director, Dave Thompson. That's after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck. Buying, selling, investing, and estate planning. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, pleased to be joined by Prairie Public's news director, Dave Thompson, as we analyze last night's Republican gubernatorial debate between Lieutenant Governor Tammy Miller and Representative Kelly Armstrong. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. Glad to be here.
What did you learn, Dave, about the two candidates?
What I learned is both are very pro-life. Both believe that North Dakota is on the right track with its abortion bans. North Dakota is on the right track with its preventing transgender athletes from competing in girls' sports. Those were areas of agreement. I didn't see a lot of disagreement except over whether or not they are career politicians, which I found very interesting.
I thought that was maybe the place where they tried to differentiate each other, one as a career business executive, the other as a career politician. I'm not sure where that went. What was your take from that at the end of the night?
I'm not exactly sure where that went, too. I think they both made points. Tammy talks about her administrative experience. Kelly talks about the fact that he had a lot of business experience, but as a legislator, that is, you're not full-time, so you're not a full-time politician. You know, they didn't differentiate a lot about having more money in a legal fund if you need to sue the EPA. They were fine with that. They were also talking about more transparency in the legacy fund and more transparency on things like the Wayne Stengem deleted emails. They want to prevent that from happening.
I thought the lieutenant governor was a little bit on the defensive there, trying to say, hey, look, there is transparency already in the legacy fund. Did you agree with that?
Yes, I did. And the reason is because she kind of chairs the investment board. And the investment board deals with legacy fund investments and how that's going to go. I think there's going to be more of an issue on the legacy fund. This is my own personal opinion. Maybe not necessarily leading up to the primary, but maybe after the primary and into the general election. Watch that one as a potential hidden issue.
So where do these two Republican gubernatorial candidates now go, Dave? Really, the primary isn't that far away.
No, we don't have a lot of time, so you rely on ads, and you know the ads have been a little bit negative here and there. That has been an interesting dynamic in this race. They were negative ads, but when they actually met face-to-face, it was kind of more friendly.
You tried to talk about negative advertising.
Right.
What was your perspective of the response? Are we going to see more of it, less of it, or really they were just fine to be in the same room together, but we're going to have a little more status quo of negative advertising from the rest of the way
out here?
That
was my thought, too, and there might be some more negative ads, some new ones coming up. I'm only saying might because we really don't know that much about it. It's just the impression I got.
You shared with me earlier, Dave, that you had a set of questions prepared and the candidates really blew through them. You thought there would be more back and forth?
Yes. And there wasn't a lot of back. There was some back and forth. And the one question I came up with, and it had to do with Second Amendment, was a follow-up when I asked about the red flag law. And I thought we might get more debate on that. We didn't.
It has to do with gun control.
That is correct. And it was Lieutenant Governor Miller who brought up we need more mental health services for people to prevent them from become, you know, mass shooters, that type of thing. And, you know, red flag is supposed to try to nip that in the bud in the beginning. And then Congressman Armstrong came up with the interesting comments. She said, it's a good idea, but it's unconstitutional.
Thought both candidates in the end, fervent President Trump supporters.
Correct.
Very much supporting the energy industry and its continued presence here in North Dakota.
That's right.
Maybe a little different on workforce development, Dave, I noticed in the debate.
Yeah, there was a bit of workforce development. They both did talk about growing the workforce from, you know, inside North Dakota, but there was a bit of a difference when it came to the follow-up that I asked about. What about the efforts that they had bring Ukrainians to the oil fields to fill jobs? We have a lot of jobs that are open in North Dakota. There was some uneasiness at that point.
Another point that I noticed that really wasn't talked about after Representative Armstrong said it was perhaps the need to help with some sort of subsidies for North Dakota students.
I thought that was
interesting. To help them perhaps pay off student loan debt in the future and then stay in the state. But it was a non-issue because the lieutenant governor didn't counter that.
No, she didn't. And, you know, it's interesting they're talking about that, but a loan forgiveness program means if you get a degree, say, in law, then you have to go to a North Dakota city and practice law in order to get your loans forgiven. So that was an interesting response, but I was expecting more.
Dave Thompson, he was the moderator at last night's Republican gubernatorial debate here at Prairie Public. Dave, still more to cover with these two candidates down
the
road.
More to cover, that's right. The primary's coming up, so watch for it.
Thanks for joining us, Dave. More Main Street is ahead.
Plains Art Museum in Fargo is hosting its Spring Gala 2024 Sci-Fi Artistry on Saturday, May 4th from 7 p.m. until midnight, featuring food, wine tasting, art auction, and dancing into the night to post-traumatic funk syndrome and Star 4. Proceeds benefit museum education and accessibility. More information and tickets at plainsart.org.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
Okay, who is hungry? It's time for Prairie Plates, and I'm joined now by Rick Guillon. And Rick, boy, just a day in the life of Rick Guillon. you were just telling me before we started recording here that you were at yet another sort of eating competition, not a judge this time, but this time about wings. And so you're feeling very inspired to talk about chicken wings. And specifically, this one was a fundraiser for the Veterans Warrior Foundation. 37 competitors
37.
Here for chicken wings. I don't even know how to come up with 37 different variations of chicken wings. But let's start with the basics here. I'm going to ask the most obvious question that if we weren't separated by a pane of glass, you'd probably smack me for asking. Can you only make a chicken wing off of one part of a chicken?
Well, that's a good question. And chicken wings vary at restaurants from smaller size to like whole legs sometimes. I've had them or whole wings and not split up. Various sizes, various versions, a lot of flavors. Back to the event at the Moorhead Legion on Saturday, they had flats and drummies, and that's it. So no larger like legs or I've never seen whole thighs, I guess, but it'd be kind of overload.
For people who really care about this kind of thing, you know, you do need to spend a fair amount of time getting stuff right. So set us up with the very basics here. When you're even looking for the chicken to buy, do you look for any specific, you know, it's not like last week when we were talking about steaks and there were all these different cuts, but is there something to look for in the chicken itself when you're buying it?
I like a combo of flats and drummies, and that's kind of the...
I don't know what you mean by flats.
Lingo. Those are the smaller ones with the two bones in it that are kind of shaped like, I don't even know, not an oval, but you'll have to look it up.
Flat. I am Googling this right now.
You should
chicken
do it.
Flats?
Flats versus drummies. And there's a flat on that second photo I see.
Okay. Oh.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, boy, that's really getting inside baseball here about chicken wings because they don't look that different to me. But okay, fair. They're about the same size, but one has a little bit more, not quite pear-shaped, but you know, bigger on top and then smaller on the bottom, and then the other one is more just the same shape throughout. So, okay, anyway, moving on. buying the chicken, you're buying flats, you're buying wings. Do you want to be buying, like, does it matter if they have been antibiotic treated chickens or cage free? Can you tell that level of flavor when they're going to be battered and fried, etc.?
I do buy a lot of organic chicken when I go to the grocery store, and yeah, I mean, it's going to be a little bit more expensive, but it's usually a higher quality chicken, but usually with flats and drummies, you're not going to find a lot of organic specialty chicken. So you kind of have to stick with the basics. And a lot of the guys there were marinating them or brining them, which is a good idea, I think, because chicken doesn't have a ton of flavor. I mean, they both are bone in, so you're going to get some flavor, but I do like a marinade or a brine. A lot of guys were deep frying them. A lot of guys were smoking them and also charcoal firing them on some charcoal grills, which I thought was really, really neat to see.
Hmm.
And then there was another competitor that was poaching them kind of in a sweet soy and then searing them on the flat top and then adding in some more Asian ingredients, kind of like some peanuts and cilantro and red chilies and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
So a lot of, you can cook chicken wings in an air fryer. You can bake them. If you want really crispy skin, you pretty much have to put them in the deep fryer. The air fryer is okay, but the deep fryer really is the way to go. And some people.
What is it about? I mean, is the obvious answer, it's the oil, Ashley, that makes them that crispy that you just can't quite get the same out of an air fryer?
Yeah, it's the oil, and some people will double fry them at a lower temperature than a higher temperature, kind of like a double blanch for a French fry, just to get them really crispy. They'll coat them in. One of my friends was coating them in cornstarch, so kind of a light, crispy coating there. Some people were coating them in regular flour. Sometimes with chicken wings, if you use flour, it gets a little too thick. You want either crispy skin or just a real kind of thin layer, in my opinion, anyway. And we can move on to some of the sauces and varieties, because there is a lot of them. If you go to Buffalo Wild Wings, for instance, there's, I don't know, a dozen varieties of sauces, dry rubs. It's really a kind of a panoply of.
What's a sauce versus a dry rub?
Well, the dry, and I wouldn't call it a rub. It would just be a dry spice, probably a paprika, black pepper, salt, garlic powder, onion. That would be one that would be pretty standard you would see, but it was just like a dry spice blend, I guess. And then after they come out of the fryer or air fryer or whatever, off the grill, you would toss them in that dry spice rub. And those can be really good, but I think around here, a lot of people like their wings sauced with a side of ranch or blue cheese. I didn't see any celery or carrots at all at this event. And some people like cauliflower wings, which are just little flowerettes, and they batter them or whatever and fry them and then toss them in buffalo sauce or barbecue sauce. And those actually can be quite good, too, if you're not into meat. So, It's a whole world.
You know, I often use nutritional yeast in flavoring things. Like I've made some vegan cheese with nutritional yeast, or sometimes I just put it on top of other things. Would that be a good addition to a cauliflower wing if you wanted it to taste like chicken versus just a nice, lovely piece of cauliflower, which is a delightful thing to eat?
Yeah, I think if you put some in the batter or maybe in a like a dry spice blend, you could probably get away with that. I mean, that sort of thing boosts umami to me.
Yeah.
So I probably would fit in a cauliflower wing. Yeah.
Okay. You said something about charcoal. I feel like that is not as common.
It's not, and it should be, because that's my preference. If I were to do wings, I would probably charcoal fire them, maybe put some wood chips in there. And then if I had a deep fryer, I would then deep fry them. Because, I know.
It's all the way or no way with Rick Guion, I think.
I like crispy skin. There's a restaurant in town, Pounds, here down the way in downtown Fargo, that they will low and slow cook the wings in pork fat for a while and confit them in pork fat technically, and then they will deep fry those wings.
And you just said, you know, and they'll confit them as if everybody knows what that means.
So you're going to kind of braise something in fat. They do it a lot with duck thighs and legs, and then they'll shred the meat off. But you can use that technique in other areas such as wings. So, yeah, and they're delicious, but I probably wouldn't eat too many of them.
Oh, boy. When you're out and about in the state, what are some of the places where you like to get wings? And before you even answer, I'll invite our listeners to send an email to plates@prairiepublic.org and let us know where you want to go get wings or how you're going to make them at home.
Yeah, you can get wings at a lot of different pubs around the state, and a lot. Dozens, you know, and people have their favorite spots, and that's great. But for me, like if I'm in Grand Forks, there's a place called Parrot's K that serves really good wings or kind of a sweet heat wing. They have really good food. I'm not going to call it a dive bar, but it's a very interesting bar.
Interesting being the North Dakota nice way of...
It's very unique. Yes.
Okay.
But they have good wings and other good food. On kind of the grilled wing front, Toasted Frog in Grand Forks and Fargo has a good grilled wing. Blarney Stone in Bismarck, well, and here in Fargo, too. They have a special sauce called the Kilt Lifter habanero sauce.
The Kilt Lifter? Yeah. Oh, boy. That's terrible.
Scottish theme in an Irish bar, I guess. And then downtown Fargo here, Little Brother, I really like. They have a kind of an Asian-style sweet heat wing that's gochujang sauce a little bit or sweet soy.
Yeah.
They have a kind of coated in cornstarch or maybe tapioca flour. I'm not really potato flour. I'm not really sure, but crispy, crispy, yeah, very crispy.
Yeah. Were there any flavor combinations that stood out to you from this past event or ones that you've heard about that maybe people wouldn't think to try?
Yeah, I tried three at this event. I'm big into like Asian crispy style wings personally, like chili garlic, sweet soy, fish sauce, caramel, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But the three I tried, because I was busy shooting photos and yakking with people at this event on Saturday at the Moorhead Legion.
Quite a life, Rick.
I do, yeah. In order to get me to shut up, people have to shove food in my mouth. So remember,
all right.
Remember
well, for
that.
For me, it's going to be to play the out music. Thanks, Rick.
Yeah, you bet.
In this Plainsfolk essay, Tom Ezern explores the early 20th century tradition of book showers in North Dakota, where club women initiated community gatherings to stock local libraries with donated books. Ezern vividly describes these events, emphasizing their dual role in enhancing library collections and strengthening community bonds. Through his narrative, Ezern highlights the transformative power of literacy and communal effort, inviting reflection on their value in contemporary society.
When club women across North Dakota learned by newspaper exchange that their peers across the country were seeding their public libraries by means of book showers, celebratory gatherings where citizens brought in donated books to stock the shelves, they quickly made book showers a recognized community development. This emergence, generated by second-generation club women, took place in the early years of the 20th century. We can learn from these people and emulate them. We learn that the plains folk of a century ago were highly literate. They simply read more than we do. They read and wrote better than we do, and they valued all things literary, from ballads to books. And they followed the lead of their women, who were branching out from traditional roles as keepers of family into larger functions as builders of community. Book showers happened, impressively, in larger towns like Bismarck, but I am particularly interested in their appearance in country towns like Lemon, the border town with one foot in South Dakota and the other in North Dakota. In 1911, the Lemon Woman's Club proposed a book shower to enlarge the collection for a public library in a dedicated room of the high school. On a February night, the people showed up with 250 books, and they stayed for the evening until near midnight. Our forebears did not retire early from social engagements. They made a night of them, savoring the civility. Mayor Finch, we read, gave a speech in which he alluded to the strenuous task of developing an ordered community out of the raw prairie wilderness and pointed out the sweeping influence of good reading on the development intellectually of the community. Professor Salisbury, high school teachers, if well-educated, often were referred to as professor in those days, gave an excellent talk on books and literature, on the power of printed thought, and on the development of literature as traced in the development of the book. Another citizen traced the rise of education in Lemon and identified the establishment of its public library as a landmark on the trail to learning. It happened when an Episcopal priest donated his library of 600 volumes, on faith the town would find some place to put them. In between the addresses, there were musical selections by a local orchestra, soloists, a high school octet, and the recently organized town band. The ladies of the club served coffee and sandwiches. Lemon was not unusual in this manifestation of book culture at this time. It was typical. Over in Oaks, the women's club organized a book shower at the library and served refreshments to all donors. Both ladies and gentlemen have been invited, it was announced, and each one must bring a book. I wonder how many of the gentlemen had a book placed into their hands by their wives so they could come. In Walhalla, when the library assessed its book fund and found it wanting, the women announced by the press their book shower. That phrase put into quotation marks indicating it was a new thing. They served refreshments and saw to it a card bearing the donor's name went into each donated book, in case it turned out to be a duplicate and needed to be exchanged for another. And so it went. In Velva, in Mandan, in Beach, in one town after another, libraries, people demonstrated, were a recognized public good. Women adopted them as civic family. They gave us a historic model for community.
That's Tom Ezern with his Plains Folk essay. Tom is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. More Main Street is ahead.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 2 is about learning and storytelling. It states, "Traditional teaching and the passing on of knowledge and wisdom was done through storytelling, song, ceremony, and daily way of life, often incorporating specific gender and age-specific responsibilities. These continue to be some of the best modes for learning for both Native and non-Native learners." In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to Gladys Hawk, enrolled member of the Standing Rock Nation, as she talks about grandmother's stories.
In the evenings, when we had our evening prayers, then, of course, you know, the lamplight and all that, we didn't have electricity like this. Then they would sit at the table and have smoke their pipe. My grandma had her own pipe, grandpa had his. And they would have evening prayer first, and then they would socialize just by smoking, talk about things for the day. And then my grandmother would tell me, okay, you know, now it's time for your bedtime. And I would sleep with her. So she would put me to bed and then she'd start telling me stories that, I mean, your imagination can just run wild when you hear it in your language. You know, it's just like watching TV, the cartoons, it just grabs your attention. Well, it's the same thing, but it was my mind. And because of the way that she would talk and her expressions, you know, her tone of voice, or all of that, it makes the story come alive, so to speak. And so I would just be so mesmerized just listening to her talk about these stories that she told me. And usually, just at the end, you know, you're just all tense and waiting for something bad to happen. Then she says, and so, and then translating it, she'd say, "And that's why I want you to be good." She said, "Don't be like this one in the story."
I'm Sharla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous Elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org. Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
That concludes today's episode of Main Street. Thank you so much for tuning in. Join us tomorrow for our weekly segments featuring Dave Thompson, and he'll recap the news for us, and Matt Olin, who will review the foreign film housekeeping for beginners.
I feel like I could be in that movie. I don't actually know what this movie is about, but I'm very good at it.
Actually, I don't know. There's apparently a lot of chaos in this movie. I don't know if
one of us are good with chaos. Managing chaos is an important part of housekeeping. Managing chaos is actually an important part of travel. And tomorrow on the show, we are going to talk with travel writer Alicia Underlee Nelson about setting yourself up for success for the summer road trip season. We hope you enjoy the rest of your day.